Hello and welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tanitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, or CLL. This is an important program that we're offering for all of you, and we're delighted with your response to the program today. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other cancer-related organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you. We have on the call today over 650 participants on the call. And you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Bangladesh, Canada, China, Indonesia, Japan, and the United Kingdom. So really, you're from all over the world. It's a global call. And today's program has been made possible by an educational grant from Sanofi Aventis US LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials we received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about all of the different organizations that are supporting this program today and their websites and their toll-free numbers. There also is an outline about the program and information about the speakers, and there also is an evaluation form. And I'm going to ask all of you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer going forward? So we very much appreciate your feedback and suggestions. Indeed, the topic for today was one that many of you have requested and we've been able to offer. So please do, let us know what you think. Now, our first speaker for today is Dr. Michael Keating. And Dr. Keating is Professor of Medicine, Department of Leukemia, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Keating is going to present an overview of CLL, new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, and how research contributes to your treatment options. Dr. Keating?
Thanks, Carolyn. Well, it's a great honor and privilege to be speaking to the audience that represents the patients that are treated by all the hematologists and oncologists around the country and around the world. Chronic lymphocytic leukemia is a disease of increasing incidence because it's a disease that predominantly occurs in older people, so that young people tend to be surprised when they're diagnosed with CLL, but the average age of diagnosis in the United States is somewhere between 70 and 72. And because the population is aging, we tend to have more and more patients coming along. And for a long period of time, the disease was ignored because there was a lack of new treatment initiatives. But as you'll hear today, there are some very dramatic changes in the likelihood of patients receiving these old-time treatments that were of marginal effectiveness anyway. The CLL is a disease where B lymphocytes, there are two major forms of lymphocytes, B cells and T cells, and almost all of the CLLs are malignancies of the B lymphocytes, and each lymphocyte is an identical copy of the next lymphocyte, so that there is a clone of cells. And the cells are predominantly born in the bone marrow. They're then sent around the bloodstream, and they're directed to particular sites so that some go to lymph nodes, some recirculate back to the bone marrow, some go to the spleen, so that depending on the address of the clone of cells, you can have some patients that have predominantly enlargement of the lymph nodes and some predominantly enlargement of the spleen and some predominantly disease of blood and bone marrow. There's often a bit of confusion between small lymphocytic lymphoma and chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and basically they're the same biologic disease. It's just that in small lymphocytic lymphoma, the disease is predominantly in the lymph nodes, and you don't have circulating CLL cells to any great degree. there's also a lot of interest at the present time in a concept called monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis, and Dr. Zent and his colleagues have made major contributions to this, and if there are questions about this, Clive would be the appropriate person to address them. But many patients are now being diagnosed coincidentally on a routine blood test where they have a very slight increase in the lymphocyte count in the bloodstream. And it's important that we be aware that this is not a disease state in most circumstances, but just an accumulation of cells over a long period of time. So many patients these days are being diagnosed coincidentally. The patients are usually free of any symptoms, and they're quite shocked when the diagnosis is made because they feel so well. And the most important thing that we have to be aware of is that some patients, the disease will be progressive and some will be very indolent. And this is to a degree sorted out by the testing that we do ahead of time when the patient first comes in, that can be validated by what they call a watch and wait approach, where careful observation of patients over 6 months to a year will be able to sort out the patients whose disease is not growing and where no treatment is required. So there are now being fairly good guidelines as to when to initiate treatment, and these were initially the National Cancer Institute guidelines and more recently the International Working Group on CLL guidelines as to when treatment should be initiated and what the goal of treatment might be. For many years, there was strictly a palliative approach on the basis that we couldn't really prolong the outcome of patients with CLL, but we would just keep the white cell count and the lymph glands and the spleen under control. And this was predominantly with a drug chlorambucil, which is a simple, inexpensive oral medication, usually well tolerated, but of marginal effectiveness, and patients needed to stay on this for pretty much their entire life and be seeing the doctor all the time. I think that there have been some major transition points, and one was the development of the first new drug that was approved for chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which was fludarabine. And this was more potent than chlorambucil, so that we got to the point where we could demonstrate that not only were we able to improve the clinical situation, but in many patients you would get to the point where you couldn't find any evidence of disease in the blood, the bone marrow, and the lymph glands on examination. And these patients were now achieving complete remission in about 20 to 25% of cases versus 3 to 5% with chlorambucil. And I think the next concept that came along was the blending of fludarabine with an alkylating agent like chlorambucil called cyclophosphamide or cytoxan. And a number of studies have shown that that combination is better than fludarabine. But the breakthrough came when there was the addition of a monoclonal antibody called rituximab or rituxan, which targets a protein on the surface of the cell called CD20. And CD is just there's a grouping of different proteins, and this is just a way that you identify the particular protein on the surface of the cell. So the two major programs which have been developed in the United States have been what they call the FCR program with fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituximab, and the PCR program, which has been to a large degree championed by the Mayo Clinic and Memorial Sloan Kettering. And these have been pretty much the standards that have been used for younger, fit, healthy patients around the country. One of the major studies that was reported at the American Society of Hematology 2 years or 15 months ago now was from the German CLL study group, where they found that the FCR program had the best complete remission rate, the longest remissions. And more recently, at the meeting in New Orleans in December, they reported that for the first time, a clinical trial in CLL had positively impacted the survival of patients with CLL. Now, the problem is that most of these studies are conducted in patients that are under the age of 70, there have been a number of studies that have been conducted specifically on patients that are older, and it's more difficult because many of these patients have other illnesses to demonstrate the benefit of some particular treatments, and this has led to a gradually increasing interest in research clinical trials that are specifically for patients that are over the age of 70. One of the things that I think is really important is clinical trials do a number of different things. One is that it provides information on the combinations, not only the positive aspects of the treatment by being able to get rid of any evidence of the leukemia, but also it gives us a description of any side effects which are likely to occur in patients receiving treatment for their CLL. And this provides a very important resource for clinicians and patients around the country. But it also provides key information for healthcare providers, insurance carriers, the Food and Drug Administration, and many of the clinical trials which are not as exciting as others are actually conducted to get evidence for the FDA that this is a safe and effective program and worthy of being approved for clinical use and approved for reimbursement. So that clinical trials have always been a feature of all oncology research. We're a very outcome-oriented group of investigators, and I have to express my tremendous admiration for patients that are willing to entrust their care to people on clinical trials or conducting clinical trials. And I would quote my mentor, Dr. Fryrak, who was one of the people that led to the cure of childhood leukemia, who said that the best form of patient care is clinical research because people are watching over everything that's happening. So that nowadays, instead of having the option of going in and having a pill just to control things and being reassured by your doctor that you're more likely to die with CLL than from CLL, I think that it's now clear that if the disease is progressive, most people these days are now dying of complications of their disease. So just keeping the lid on the disease is not a terribly effective way to go. So the research that's being conducted now is when patients require treatment to get the most effective treatment program for them to get them into preferably a complete remission or close to a complete remission that we call a partial remission. And if there are remaining cells left behind, there's a lot of research now being conducted on whether we should initiate some other intervention to clean up residual cells or minimal residual disease. And so far, it's not entirely clear the best approach that we should be taking to this. So one of the things that's been impressive to me over the last few years has been that we've gone from having a single drug, chlorambucil, or you could alternate, or you could replace that with cyclophosphamide, and you could do it with or without steroids such as prednisone, to the point now where fludarabine has been approved for use, the combinations have developed, but there is another monoclonal antibody called Campath or alemtuzumab, which is very potent in clearing blood, the bone marrow, spleen, and a little less impressive in clearing bulky lymph glands. But this was compared to chlorambucil and was approved for frontline management of CLL. It's not being used frontline to any great degree, but it's nice to have this as an agent which is approved for both frontline and refractory disease at the present time. The other drug which has been approved recently There's a drug called bendamustine, which is what they call an alkylating agent, like chlorambucil and cyclophosphamide. It's been used over in Europe, predominantly in Eastern Germany, for many, many years, more than 20 years. But as the wall came down, there was a lot more interest in the West in investigating this, and it again has been in a clinical trial comparing bendamustine to chlorambucil with a significantly better complete response rate and a longer time to treatment failure, or time when you say that the drug is just not working. So that bendamustine has ended up being approved for CLL. So the next challenge for investigators and patients now is to choose what the best approach for their particular condition is. And I've already highlighted that there is a need for us to focus attention not only on patients that are older, but patients who have other significant illnesses. Now, one of the areas that has changed quite dramatically is that we have a number of new characteristics of the cells that we can look at that give us clear guidance as to how the patient is likely to respond to particular treatments. And the two that I pay most, three that I pay most attention to, the FISH cytogenetics. This is a way that you can identify whether there's an appropriate number of particular chromosomes. There are 22 pairs of chromosomes, and in CLL you'll sometimes have three chromosome 12s, or you'll lose part or all of chromosome 11 or 13 or 17, and this is a simple, reproducible but not inexpensive test. Now, there are two major groups of CLLs, those that have gone through a normal mutation process, and these are called mutated CLL, or a group which is unmutated, and the mutated group tends to have a much better likelihood of having very long remissions. There is a test called the ZAP70, which is difficult to reproduce in a number of different laboratories. And our particular group, and it's now being supported by a number of others around the world, really, is the beta 2 microglobulin, which is an inexpensive, reproducible, simple test that we can use. So it's not exactly clear how everything should be sorted out at the present time, and we will sort that out with clinical trials. There has been a push to say, well, if treatments are very effective when the disease is advanced, is it going to be more effective early? And investigators both in the United States and Europe have been conducting early intervention clinical trials, but these are going to take many years. So I think that one of the things that I would recommend to patients is that they become aware of options, but not paralyzed by reading massive amounts, because Dr. Zent and I spend a lot of time trying to figure these things out, and we don't know all the answers. But there's a lot of talk about getting second opinions, and I think it's important that patients get what I call the best opinion. So that there are a number of areas around the United States that have true centers of excellence, and if at all possible, it would be wise for patients to get an opinion from people that are very used to seeing CLL, because most oncologists in the U.S. will only see, you know, 7 to 10 new patients a year, so that they don't get that level of experience that they do with the more common things like breast cancer, etc. So I think that I might call it to a halt from my point of view at this point, and hand it back to Carolyn to introduce Dr. Zent.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Keating, for just a very informative and comprehensive presentation, very compassionate, and really lots of information for everyone to absorb and to ask questions during the Q&A. And the comment about best opinion is so important for people to remember. That's a very important takeaway, in addition to many of the other things that you said. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Clive Zent. And Dr. Zent is a consultant hematologist, associate professor of medicine, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Zent is going to address tips to manage complications and side effects, quality of life concerns, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. I now turn the program over to Dr. Zent.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks for the opportunity to share the platform with Dr. Keating. I'd like to just give an overview of these issues, which are very important in living with CLL. As Dr. Keating told you, this is a disease of a blood cell, the B lymphocyte, which is a very important component of our immune system. And when people get CLL, often very early in their disease, one of the major problems is that they develop immune deficiencies, which are a result of the B cells disrupting normal immunity. And so one of the big issues that people have to deal with is infections, lack of immune surveillance for other problems, and also disruptions of the whole immune system that can cause you to develop autoimmune complications. This group of problems really should be considered in people with CLL who have medical issues. So infections can be a problem early on and later after treatment, one of the main problems of our treatments being further suppression of the immune system before the immune system does some degree of recovery. So one of the things that we teach our patients very early on is to be very aware of fevers and not feeling well and to get medical care very quickly. People have different thresholds, but we teach our patients that if they have a fever of 101.5 degrees or about 38.5 degrees centigrade, they should see somebody immediately. Don't wait till the next day or take Tylenol and hope they'll get better. The other big issue is to get vaccinated. Vaccines don't work very well in CLL patients, but vaccination early and appropriately is very important. One of the big problems there is people with CLL probably should not get any live vaccines, and they also need to know that their vaccines don't work as well as in other folks. So, for instance, the influenza vaccine is important to get, but people who get the influenza vaccine shouldn't think that they can't possibly get influenza because, unfortunately, they can. Nowadays, with medications such as Tamiflu, it's important to recognize this and get care immediately if you think you've got it. The other issues that are important are that people with CLL who've had treatment need to be aware that they can get some unusual infections, especially in the short term after some of the new highly effective therapies that we're using now. And then their physicians need to keep this in mind when they think about causes of fevers or other illnesses. The second part of the active monitoring of that folks need to do when they have CLL is a concern about getting second malignancies. And there's been some very interesting work in the last decade to show that people with CLL really have a significantly increased risk of second cancers. The main problem is skin cancer, both the squamous cell carcinomas and the basal cell carcinomas, which many people get, as well as melanoma. And the big issue here is prevention. So avoid sun exposure and do careful regular self-observation and see a dermatologist on a regular basis. Most of these problems can be caught early and removed, and they don't become major issues. But unfortunately, even squamous cell carcinoma can be a serious problem in patients with CLL because this disease can be quite aggressive and rapidly progressive and can sometimes even spread outside of the skin to distant organs. Other cancers are also more common in people with CLL, so it's very important to maintain primary care prophylaxis. The sort of things that people should be doing, especially after the age of 50, have become very important. And even if you're seeing somebody on a regular basis for your CLL, it's important to also see your primary care physician at least once a year and do all these precautionary measures. Now, CLL is well known to cause second or to be associated with second lymphomas or malignancies of the lymphoid cells. This certainly is an issue. Most patients and their physicians are aware of this. And again, if symptoms arise that are suggestive of this, they need to be carefully evaluated and appropriately treated. The third problem with the immune system is the problem of development of an autoimmune problem, which means that the immune system turns against itself and damages parts of the patient. It's a loss of self-recognition. The immune system usually leaves yourself alone, and if it doesn't, it can cause some serious problems. Now, most of these occur when they do in CLL by damaging your own red blood cells or platelets, or very rarely your own neutrophils. And they occur in about 1 in 20 patients with CLL through their lifetime, which is much higher than in the regular population. And one of the most important things about this is that patients and their physicians need to keep this in mind whenever somebody develops anemia or a low platelet count, because they often need a different form of therapy, and they don't always mean that you have progressive chronic lymphocytic leukemia that needs treatment. Now, another issue that patients always have, especially when they're early on in their disease, is how do you maintain your quality of life? As Dr. Keating alluded to, most patients, especially in the United States and Western Europe, are diagnosed in an early stage of their disease when they often don't know they have an illness, the so-called incidental diagnosis. And for many of these people, the diagnosis is a life-changing event, not because they have a physical illness, but because they now have something which is of major concern in their lives. And people often get very concerned about a whole lot of new problems and often change their lifestyle in a way that is not necessarily very good for them. So people often ask about exposure to other people, crowds, young children, and so on. They get scared about traveling. They get worried about doing all sorts of things that they usually enjoyed or wanted to do. And the advice that I think is most appropriate is that people should try and carry on with their lives as best they can, but with just a bit more awareness of certain potential problems, like infection, like sun exposure, and also the appreciation that they should really be aware of their ability to get medical care wherever they go. So what I mean by that is there's no real reason why people can't meet with other people and do the things they want to. Obviously, you've got to be a little bit careful about exposure to people who are obviously sick, especially when you have had chemotherapy or have other forms of immune suppression. But you don't have to limit your lifestyle severely for this. Physical fitness, I think, is a very important aspect. I always tell my patients that the diagnosis of CLL is a reason for getting fit and staying fit, because whether you need treatment now or in the future, you'll do better with treatment if you're fit and well than if you're not. So it's a reason for looking after yourself better rather than letting things go. Frequent problems about travel. I think that it's that the care for people with CLL in most of the developed world is generally very good. Patients should travel with documentation of their disease in case they have to see somebody who doesn't know them. But as I'm sure Dr. Keating would agree, therapy for CLL, or the potential for therapy for acute complications in North America, Europe, and Australasia is excellent. For places outside of that, you might have to just check up before you go. And as an African, I would say that I usually discourage my patients with CLL from going to very remote parts of the country where you could be a long way from any medical care and where you could also be exposed to things like malaria or sleeping sickness, which are probably not a great combination with CLL if you get them. Another issue about quality of life is work and continuing with work or retiring. One of the main things that people have to consider in CLL these days is that many of patients will have a very good expectation of a long period of symptom-free, high-quality life before they need any treatment. And people with those sort of that sort of disease, and we really are getting much better at predicting who they are, should try to disrupt, not to continue doing things that they would have done anyway, and not to allow their diagnosis to make major life changes, which they might regret. Another major issue that affects quality of life is who to tell. Patients often are very surprised by the diagnosis, and one of the first questions they have is, who should I tell and who needs to know? Well, it's a very individual decision. I usually encourage people to share their diagnosis with their close family if at all possible. One of the really difficult issues is often for older patients to discuss it with their adult children. Many people want to still protect their children and don't want to tell them, but that really needs to be very carefully thought out, because adult children get very upset when they're not when their parents don't confide important life events with them, and so that should really be done whenever possible. In the United States, one of the big issues for patients is what to tell the insurance companies. You can't deliberately withhold information from your insurance company, but it can be often very difficult to know who to let, to who to inform and when you have to inform them. And also, as far as work's concerned, it's very difficult to know whether you have to inform your employers because that might jeopardize your work in the future. The issue of communicating with a healthcare team. CLL is a chronic disease. Patients who have it are usually going to have it for a very long time and need at least at a minimum active observation and often a lot more than that. So it's important to find a healthcare team and healthcare provider that you're comfortable with, who knows about your disease and who is prepared to learn what they don't know so they can really treat you well. And I agree with Dr. Keating that it's often a good idea to have at least one visit to a center of excellence for CLL care. I think it's very important to be open with your healthcare providers and to discuss all your concerns, to have a separate primary care physician who can take care of those issues, and to set up a program of both regular follow-up and also have a system where you can get care very quickly if you need it, at least have an emergency contact, because CLL has not necessarily frequent but often very important unexpected events where you really need to be able to contact somebody quickly to discuss the issues and to find out how quickly you need care and what would be appropriate care. So that, I hope, gives just at least an outline of all the issues that I was asked to cover, and I'd be happy to take questions on any of these in question time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zan, for just a really excellent presentation and very considerate of all of the different quality of life issues and concerns that many people have, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you very much. Very informative. Our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker. He's program coordinator of blood cancers, project coordinator, mind-body program for cancer care. And Rick is going to review some of the free services that you can access from cancer care. Rick?
Thanks, Carolyn. Hello, and I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. Keating and Zent. Thank you. Today I'd like to tell you how cancer care services can help you in dealing with a diagnosis of CLL and build a little bit within the context on what Dr. Zent was talking about. For most people, their CLL care is handled by a healthcare team which includes their doctor, an oncology nurse, and social worker, and other specialists. While each member specializes in a certain area, they are all working together to coordinate your care. Since they operate in the team, the nurse and social worker are aware of your treatment plan and can offer expert advice or guide you to someone who can when your doctor is not available. For patients as well as family members, there are numerous issues related to treatment which will impact your lives, such as concerns about insurance, workplace issues, or treatment side effects and their possible impact on normal activities of daily living. These are common concerns and can create anticipatory anxiety and uncertainty. The good news is at some point the whole process will become familiar to you and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with your healthcare team are so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. And here are some brief tips to guide you. Do your research. The internet is a good place to start, but there are many helpful organizations, such as Cancer Care, that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Number two, take your time. Sometimes saying, I need a day or two to think about this, offers opportunity to catch your breath and get valuable feedback from loved ones and other respected resources. And three, speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. Cancer Care has been around for over 60 years. We provide information on resources and strategies for finding help. We assist people in need with financial grants, as well as counseling interventions with master's degree oncology social workers. We run regional face-to-face groups, as well as national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones, which provide emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. We archive these Connect workshops on podcasts on our webpage so people can access them easily and as often as needed. For many people, support groups, education, and social supports go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE or www.cancercare.org, see our website, or info@cancercare.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick, for providing all this information about our services and also for your words of inspiration. Thank you very much. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and I'm going to ask Trinitha to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions and let the questions begin. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Allison S. Go ahead, please.
When you have anemia that's getting worse, what is the treatment? Do you treat the anemia or the leukemia first? What is the treatment for that if you have very bad anemia? As well.
Dr. Zend, could you address that question? Thank you. Thank you for the question.
Okay, well, thanks for the question. Anemia is not a diagnosis, it's a description. And there are many different reasons why you could have anemia and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. One of them is progression of the disease itself, displacing bone marrow, normal bone marrow tissue and preventing you from making red blood cells. Second is that you could have autoimmune complications where you're making antibodies and destroying your red cells or the early developing red cells, or you could have any other form of anemia that anybody else could have. And so the first thing to do is to get an accurate diagnosis. And based on an accurate diagnosis, the decision can be made on how to treat it. So for instance, if it is progressive disease, that is an indication for initiating therapy. If it's autoimmune disease, it really depends how extensive the CLL is as to whether you have to treat both at the same time or just the autoimmune disease, which is a different treatment sometimes from the chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And then, of course, there are lots and lots of other reasons for anemia, one of the most common being iron deficiency, but there are lots of others, and they need particular treatment. So the most important thing is to get an accurate diagnosis, which can be done usually with blood tests, but often needs a bone marrow test as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for that question, Allison. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Bob L. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, excellent, Bob. Your question?
Okay, yes. My question is for Michael Keating. I was treated with FCR last year and diagnosed in 2002. And I'm curious. I'm in complete remission now. Thank you, Dr. Keating. And I'm just wondering, for this second round, for those who are elderly and need a second set of treatments, how do you determine whether you're refractory to any of the fludarabine, Cytoxan, or Rituxan? And is the refractory condition just for the fludarabine and Cytoxan or also to the monoclonal antibody Rituxans?
Okay, thank you very much, Bob, for that question. Dr. Keating, would you address that question in a general way?
It's information which is just emerging because despite the fact that FCR has now been around for more than 10 years, where there's a relatively small number of patients that have relapsed during that time. And so we don't have a big database, but as a rule of thumb, if patients relapse in the first 3 months, they're less likely to get responses to re-challenging with the same set of drugs. And if they relapse after 3 years, 5, 10, whatever, they tend to do very much better by being re-challenged. It's important that not only do you make the treatment decision, but reevaluate whether additional genetic changes have occurred during the course of treatment. because in particular if patients have abnormalities in chromosome 17, it will tend to direct you to monoclonal antibodies, which tend to work better in that environment than straight chemotherapy drugs. It's also important that depending on how good a remission patients have to the first and the second treatments as to whether at some point we have to consider the use of a stem cell transplant from a brother, sister, etc., or an unrelated donor. So that re-evaluation at the time of recurrence is pretty key, and unfortunately we don't have as much solid information to give directions to doctors as we would like, but it's emerging as time goes on.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Tess B. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi there. My question is for Dr. Keating. First, I just want to say it's such an honor to be speaking to you. I was diagnosed this past year. I'm 39. I'm now 40. And I have found out that I'm unmutated. I was in a clinical trial, and I'm CD38 positive, ZAP70 positive, all the bad things. Now, my doctor here in Winnipeg, we don't perform the FISH analysis here. And my question to you is, when I need treatment, how important is it for me to have that test done, and how would it change the regime that they would give me?
Thank you for that question.
I think it is, I think it is a very important issue, because the FISH really is sorting out two particular or three patterns. One, if you have a significant number of cells with abnormalities in chromosome 17, the likelihood of getting a very good remission is less likely, and eventually many of these patients will be recommended for a stem cell transplant, particularly in someone as young as you. The second group are those that have lost chromosome 11, and they have a very good likelihood of getting complete remission. But the remissions don't last as long as the patients that have other genetic changes. And if you have chromosome 13 or 12 or no changes, they tend to have the best likelihood of having long remissions. So having that test done will give you some idea as to the longer-term vision of what you will be dealing with as the treatment goes along.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Fred T. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much for this information. I'm 63 years old, newly diagnosed, 11q deletion with all negative prognostic markers, had the FISH test, Genzyme and all that. What I'm not seeing now that I have this elephant in the room is any sense of whether I'm likely to be a week, a month, a year, or whatever from beginning to present symptoms. So it's pretty unsettling. And is there any work being done in terms of being able to prognosticate how long from early diagnosis to when things are likely to start showing?
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask actually both Dr. Keating and Dr. Zan to address that question in a general way so everyone can benefit from the answer to that. Dr. Keating, do you want to go first?
Well, I think the group at Mayo have done some very nice work on looking at the genetics and their impact. But you have to realize that all of these prognostic factors that are so-called bad prognostic factors are just generalizations. On average, people will behave in a different way. The best clue, really, is just to follow the disease and have it checked every 3 months or so for a year, because a number of patients will have a series of bad prognostic factors but will not have progression of their disease. And there's not a clear there's not a strong relationship between the type of disease and whether patients are symptomatic or not. But I think Clive will be able to give good input into this from the Mayo perspective.
Sure, thank you. First of all, I agree that this is a statistical prognostic factor, which means it applies to populations and it has a probability of applying to an individual, but it does not directly apply to that individual. So there are people with 11q22 deletion who go for a long time without needing treatment, and there's some that have more aggressive disease. But I think this and the previous question bring up a very important new development in the field, which is understanding that both of these genes, both of these chromosome abnormalities cause a loss of important genes in a pathway known as the P53 pathway, which is sort of one of the policing pathways in the body. This is a pathway which detects defects in your DNA integrity, stops the cell from growing, and then either allows the cell to heal itself or actually causes that individual bad cell to die. And 11q22 deletion results in loss of a gene called ATM, which is an important part of this DNA damage detection and protection pathway. And the 17p13 is actually the site of the P53 gene. And one of the most interesting things that's happening in the biology of CLL research at the moment is trying to understand better ways of actually telling us whether the P53 pathway is intact or whether it's broken. And remembering that you have two copies of every gene, for the most part, losing one copy of P53 or one copy of ATM is probably less important than losing one copy and having a defect in the other. So I think that one of the things that we're probably going to start seeing in the next few years is the ability to test the pathway in its entirety rather than just looking at small parts of it, which is what we do with the FISH test at the moment. And so I think that the advice to the question is this tells you that you are at higher risk of progression, but it doesn't tell you that you will progress, and so you need to be watched carefully. I agree 100% with that. But in the broader context, I think this is one of the places where we're going to see quite a lot more development and a major improvement in our ability to predict the course of individual patients' disease over the next few years.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from James R. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I have been suggested to take a treatment with bendamustine and Rituxan. Have not been treated yet, but I was wondering if there's been any research that or clinical trials that compare bendamustine and Rituxan as a treatment strategy for frontline treatment with the other ones like FCR or PCR.
Okay, thank you for that question.
I might have a try at that if you like.
Please.
Bendamustine and rituximab has been looked at much more in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma than it has in CLL. At the hematology meeting in December, there was a report of a phase 2 study that is trying to get some idea of the efficacy of the bendamustine rituximab regimen. And it appears to be a well-tolerated treatment up front. And the results from Germany in a multinational study suggest that there's about a 33% complete remission rate. Now, the same investigators in what's called a CLL8 study that had FCR showed that the complete response rate was 44%. So right now the German frontline study is comparing FCR versus bendamustine rituximab. I think they're accruing very rapidly onto that protocol. So we should get early results from it in the next 2 years. But it seems to be an effective regimen. It's not been demonstrated as yet to be more effective than the other combination programs that have been around for a longer period of time. And in particular, we don't have much long-term follow-up on that particular combination.
Thank you.
So if I can just add something there,
yes.
I agree with everything Dr. Keating says, and I think that if this is being done outside of a clinical trial, I think we have a much better, a lot more knowledge on the current regimens, the FCR, PCR type of regimens, and I would not encourage anybody to get bendamustine and rituximab off protocol at this stage.
Excellent. Okay, our next question. Thank you.
Our next question is from Evelyn B. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Keating. You mentioned that SCLL is principally in the lymph nodes rather than the blood. Is there a blood marker that could tell you when to initiate treatments if one has been on watch and wait?
Excellent question. Thank you, Evelyn.
If patients have SLL, the tumor that you follow is not the blood counts, but if there are lymph glands that you can feel, whether there are increases in the blood, in the lymph glands that you can feel in the armpits and the neck and the groin, etc. Some patients will have small lymphocytic lymphoma, predominantly in abdominal lymph glands, and in that circumstance, they need to have CT scans done over a period of the year to see whether there's any increase. There are some pretty good rules of thumb that's now been established that the beta 2 microglobulin is a very good marker of pretty much all of the lymphoid malignancies, and if the beta 2 microglobulin is high, the disease is more likely to progress, and in particular if it keeps on going up over time. So you can't follow the blood counts directly, but you can follow some of these other parameters. I would discourage people from having CT scans too often. There have been some concerns raised that maybe a little exaggerated, but the radiation dose from CT scans has been questioned in the last 6 months or so. So I would think that from my practice, I would probably have a CT scan done at the time of diagnosis. From a staging point of view, I would probably have another one done in 6 months and 12 months and put that information together to decide whether it was growing or not. Clive and I both have many patients with small lymphocytic lymphoma that we have been following for 2, 5, 10 years without having any evidence of progression and any need for treatment.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Edmund E. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Keating. I was treated back in 2000 with the vaccine that was developed for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I know the Genotope Corporation was actually accepting patients with CLL when they, I guess, went under financially. I was wondering what your view is on vaccines in the future for both diseases.
Well, I'll let you know some of the vaccine approaches that that we're involved with, and Clive can tell you some of the things that the Mayo and their group are involved with. You know, most vaccines are complicated because, in particular, the Genotope vaccine had to be manufactured against a particular protein which was unique to each patient. So it was cumbersome, expensive, and took a long period of time to develop. There is actually now a gene which is called ROR1, or R-O-R-1, and this is a gene which is present in a number of cells before birth, and then it disappears from all cells, except it's present in the vast majority of patients with CLL. So it's quite possible now that we may be able to develop vaccines against the protein which is manufactured by the ROR1 gene. So that Tom Kipps, in association with the CLL Global Research Foundation, is developing a DNA vaccine against ROR1, which can be injected either into the skin or the muscle, and we won't have to have a vaccine which is very specific for any one patient, because it will be directed against the disease of CLL, where most of the patients have this target. So one of the problems that we have is how effective vaccines are in CLL. We find that they don't have good responses to the Pneumovax vaccine or perhaps the flu vaccine. So whether this sort of vaccine is going to be effective without some tweaking, we don't really know. Clive, what are you doing at Mayo from vaccine development point of view?
We're not doing anything for vaccine. It's absolutely correct. One of the problems with CLL is you don't respond to new antigens very well at all. Until we understand why and can fix that, it's difficult to see how vaccines are going to make an enormous difference at this stage. The idiotype antibody, which is what the genotype was, really might be a problem in CLL as well, because CLL doesn't express the antibody at very high levels like follicular lymphoma or some of the other diseases. So there you'd have a poor immune response and not much of a target to chase. So it's hard to see how this is going to help a lot unless we have a major shift and a much better understanding of the defects of the immune system and how we can fix them.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from David C. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a recent diagnosis. My question is sort of two-part. Is it better to start treatment early with the FCR, PCR, whatever might be recommended? Are there supplements and diets that might be helpful at this stage? And where are the centers of excellence? I live in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Dr. Keating, would you like to address that question? Thank you for that question, David. And it has applications for many people on the call. Thank you.
Yes, the early intervention approach is now being looked at, as I mentioned earlier. The studies that were done with chlorambucil and prednisone in the past showed that you would delay other treatments, but it had no impact on long-term outcome. But I think now that we have much better treatments, it's worthwhile asking the questions in patients that really have a need for an early intervention, and people are using a variety of markers to identify the higher risk group of patients that should be considered for these clinical trials. Now, again, early intervention outside a clinical trial is not recommended because all of the treatments that we have at the present time, as Clive mentioned, have a negative impact on the immune system. And as we go along, we're going to need the immune system more and more for some of these ways that we can target the immune system to attack the CLL cells. And I don't recommend any particular supplements for patients with CLL, but people at the Mayo have done some nice work with the green tea chemicals, so Clyde might like to comment on that.
Dr. Sam?
Yeah, well, green tea is still, you know, we're doing the studies. We don't really have results. We can't recommend it at this time. There's anecdotes of patients having very nice responses to green tea, but I don't know that we can really recommend it. But the ones, and I agree that most supplements and diets are really, you know, good healthy diets, what's really important, keeping fit. The one thing that is looking interesting, especially up here in the frozen northern part of the country where we don't see the sun very much, is vitamin D. It's become evident that a lot of people who live in the northern part of the world are vitamin D deficient. It may have a role in the immune system, obviously bone metabolism, and even some preliminary data that it might decrease some cancers from forming. But what's really important is that we're now recommending to most patients that they stay out of the sun as much as possible because of the very high risk of skin cancer. And so it may be reasonable for people with CLL who now are going to stay out of the sun in the future to have their vitamin D levels checked, and if they're low, to go onto a vitamin D supplement. 1,000 international units a day of vitamin D3 is probably not dangerous and could be very helpful.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Our speakers have been extraordinary today. I just want to thank you. This has been an extraordinary call. So I want to thank our speakers for just being so phenomenal. I want to thank all of you for asking such fantastic questions. Your questions, we know that you ask the questions obviously to get help for your particular concern, but by asking the question, it ends up helping everybody. It gives our speakers a chance to elaborate further on the points that you raised. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. Now, I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So I just all want to remind all of you that you do have resources to call after this call ends. If you had a question that you didn't get to ask, if you have a concern, please do call Cancer Care, 1-800-813-HOPE. or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And, of course, you have the listing of all the other resources as well to contact. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I do not want anyone to feel that you are alone in coping with cancer, in coping with CLL. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we're all simply a telephone call away or visiting the website, email away, from getting help. So please do take advantage of these free resources, and we are here to help you. And I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I want to thank you all for participating on this extraordinary program. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.